Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and just sit back and relax because we're going to be sharing some tales and information with you, not only about the world of the circus, which, my goodness, I don't know of anybody that doesn't enjoy a good circus, but we're going to be stepping back in time, a time when there was the big top, a time when things were different in their own special magical way. We're not only going to be talking about the circus, but we're also going to be talking about Tinkerbell. Mm-hmm. There was a real Tinkerbell. My guest today is Janet Davis, and she is the one that put together Tiny Klein's memoir, this amazing woman that was really a pipsqueak. Janet, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Donna. It's great to be here.
I hope I didn't insult her by saying she was a pipsqueak. She was so tiny.
Absolutely.
No wonder Disney looked at her and said, "That's my Tinkerbell."
Absolutely. And she was actually very proud of being so small. She changed her name to Tiny Klein, which in Yiddish and German means tiny, tiny.
Tiny, tiny. My husband made a comment about that. He said, "Tiny, tiny, isn't that a bit redundant?"
Absolutely.
Now, Janet, you're the Associate Professor of American Studies and History at the University of Texas in Austin.
Yes.
And you have had a passion for the circus because you've written some other stuff about the circus.
Yeah.
What got you all involved with this petite, amazing woman? And how did you get started with all of this stuff?
Yeah, it's been a really funny and long path. I grew up, I spent the majority of my childhood in Wisconsin, which is a real circus center in the United States. It's, you know, located at kind of crossroads being in the Midwest, and a lot of circuses started in Wisconsin in the 19th and 20th centuries. And so as a child, I really grew up with the circus. There was Circus World Museum in Baraboo and a annual circus parade in Milwaukee, and the circus trains came rolling through Madison, and so the circus was always with me. But I became interested in the circus as a scholarly subject, actually, when I was in graduate school in South Asian history, which is a kind of odd way to come back to the American circus.
It sure doesn't seem like, yeah, I think
yeah.
so.
Yeah, and what happened was I was down in, I was in Chicago at the Museum of Science and Industry, and I was looking at all sorts of wonderful displays, you know, giant pendulums, displays of the human body, and there was a wonderful pictorial display of circus parades from the turn of the 20th century. And a lot of what I saw in those images were some of the images of kind of popular cultural representations of South Asians and South Asia that I was so interested in studying as a student of South Asian history. And so I thought, wow, this is all in the circus, and what about all these little towns that all of these camels and elephants and people from around the world are parading in? You know, 100 years ago, towns,
mm-hmm.
just whole towns watching these events.
Oh, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
My goodness, it was big time stuff.
Absolutely. And so because of this kind of power of this cultural icon in that period, I thought, what's going on here? I need to study this. I need to figure this out. And so one of the serendipitous things that happened was that I was in graduate school at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and lo and behold, Circus World Museum, the place of countless field trips in my youth, also happened to have the world's largest public circus archive. Yeah, so it was really great to be able to go to such a, you know, a wonderful, rich location for all of these route books and show programs and posters and and correspondence and everything you could imagine that would help me to resurrect this rich, wonderful world of the 19th and 20th centuries.
It is a rich world. In fact, today, any posters, memorabilia from those days is richly treasured.
Yes.
By so many lovers of that particular environment.
Yes.
I remember when I was quite small, my dad taking me, I think, to one of the very last big tops that were ever allowed in the Los Angeles area.
Mm.
And I'm not that old, but I can remember as a little girl being seated up on the planks that they had for seats, and everything was held by these thick cables of rope, and I've been scared to death. And I remember him getting me something, and I was holding it in my hand, and I was afraid to breathe because I was sure.
Yeah.
We were up on the very last row. I was sure that thing was going to collapse.
Yes, absolutely.
But there were the smells.
Yeah.
There were the aromas. And the last tented circus I can recall of was in, Burbank, California.
Mm.
And this, I think, was back in the 70s. There was a group that was going around the country, and they were doing the big top. But, of course, there's no land available now.
Right.
But there was still some land available at that time. And it was a real flashback, because even though I was so small when I went to the one, the smells, you don't forget.
Yes.
The smells of the elephants, and they had the side tent where you had the oddballs and the strange people, and they really weren't strange at all when I went through. Of course, I'm an adult when I'm doing this,
right.
And I've got my daughter with me, but regardless, you don't forget those things. So it really is magical.
Yeah.
But here you are, you're a student, you've gotten involved in this, you now, as a mature woman, you have decided to write this story about Tiny.
Yeah.
Now, how in the world, number one, did you get enough information about this lady? Because I don't know how many people actually write their own stories that are in the circus, much less in everyday life.
Yes.
And then to pick her out, tell us how you got there.
Yeah. Well, it all came back to Baraboo, Wisconsin again, where I was doing my research on my first book on the circus itself. And there was one of the archivists at this library named Fred Dollinger. He said, Janet, we have this manuscript. We don't know where it came from, but it's written by this amazing performer who hung by her teeth in the circus. Her name was Tiny Klein, and we've got lots of historical evidence saying that, of course, she was a real person. She was part of several shows, and we don't know who gave us this manuscript. And actually, it was two manuscripts, two versions of her life. And so Fred said, Janet, I mean, if we could ever figure out the copyright issues with this, it would be fantastic if you could be, you know, the person to annotate it, you know, bring to life all these people that she talks about in this memoir, and to edit it down to a more manageable size and to kind of give us a sense of who this person was. And I thought, wow, I would love to do this. And then, of course, I found out that at age 70, this person, Tiny Klein, became Tinkerbell at Disneyland.
Never. When you were 7 years of age, you were watching Tinkerbell.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And this was even before, actually, when she became Tinkerbell, the year that she died was the year that I was born. And so, yes, I watched, you know, on television later on, but boy, I was just amazed by this. And I thought, we've got to figure this out. And so, you know, dealing with current copyright law about manuscript possession and everything. And so I talked to some authorities at the University of Texas, because I was now at the university, and I was able to get a hold of Tiny Klein's probate records. And in those probate records, I found out who she gifted her writings to. And that became the key that unlocked the manuscript in terms of being able to move forward with publication and research. And so she had gifted her writings to a man named Sam Abbott, who had written as an amusement reporter in the 1940s through 1970s. And he gave her writings to the museum. But they had lost track of who had actually given these writings to them. And so this manuscript had languished, because copyright laws today dictate that if there's no clear copyright, that copyright will extend to 70 years after an author's death before any of those materials can be released.
That's true.
Yeah.
So that's something, folks, just as a sidetrack here, if you have any materials you want that you have published, make sure you will them to somebody so that they can do something, and they just won't happen to languish. But, you know, maybe
that's
it was
right.
Time for it to languish, because here you are,
yeah.
A young woman who has an absolute passion for the medium of the circus. You have wonderful memories.
Yeah.
You became acquainted with people at the top museum in the country regarding this. And then you have this opportunity, serendipitously, I love that word, that comes into your environment, and then you go with it.
Yeah.
What an adventure this must have been. Now, how long did you work through her material? What did it take for you to be able to put this together? Because this book, this is quite comprehensive. I mean,
thank you.
Is wonderful.
Thank you. It has been a wild ride. It has taken longer than I anticipated, owing to, you know, I think that happens with many authors, that one's own life circumstances, you know, comes into play as one tries to get something done. And, you know, so there was a special poignancy in the finishing and researching of this book, coinciding with my mom's own illness, which was relatively brief, with cancer and her passing. And thinking about this person, Tiny Klein, who became Tinkerbell when she was 70 and was diagnosed with cancer just a year later.
Mm-hmm.
And so there she was, working, climbing up the Matterhorn at Disneyland every night. And, you know, it's 146 feet up in the air, and she's gliding across, knowing that, you know, she's, her body itself is fragile. But yet there she goes every night doing this work and loving it. And being so happy. And so just that own, you know, my own kind of process of researching and writing was so inspired by her strength.
Mm-hmm.
Always. I mean, that was the thing that just was so much fun and so fulfilling in doing this work. And so it really came slowly. I spent a lot of time in the archives at Circus World and at other libraries around the country, the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts, among others. And so I did that kind of scholarly work, but during this process, I met people, and met people who had met a former neighbor of Tiny Klein's when she lived in Inglewood, California. I met family members of hers. She never had kids of her own, but her husband, Otto, who died, you know, just after 5 weeks of marriage.
Yeah, that was a story. Boy,
yeah.
Oh boy.
So okay. Sad.
Yeah, and so, go on, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's all right. And so, Otto's family is still very much centered in the Naperville, Illinois area. And so I made a lot of contact with those folks, too. And they were incredibly generous with their memories and their, you know, and their knowledge of the family. And so the project grew out of that, you know, that archival foundation and that sense of, you know, really wonderful community with all of these people who knew and loved Tiny Klein.
Well, let's talk about this amazing, tiny, tiny woman that had jaws of steel because of the acts that she did.
Yeah.
But they evolved. And in this book, A Circus Queen and Tinkerbell, the memoir of Tiny Klein, it is so amazing when you think of the world that she grew up in and how she came over. She was Hungarian, Jewish. She ended up having to become a burlesque dancer. But let's talk a little bit about how that evolved for her.
Yeah.
Because in her era, oh boy, you were a bad girl if you got into that group.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's such a funny evolution, because she arrives in America all alone, and she's 14 years old. And, you know, this is in January of 1905, and she comes with a Hungarian dance troupe and lands in New York City at Ellis Island, like so many millions of other Americans, you know, other immigrants to America. And she lived initially at a boarding school for young Jewish women from Eastern Europe. And this was a boarding school, the Clara de Hirsch Home, for immigrant working girls, in which these young women were being trained to be respectable, assimilated Americans, and being trained in needlework and domestic service, in jobs that would hopefully remove them from the temptations of, you know, bad kinds of work. And so Tiny lived, and her name at this time was Helen Deutsch. And so as a 14-year-old girl, after she had been dancing and then living in this boarding school, she lived there for a while. I don't know how long she was there. We can't find the records of her exact stay in the boarding school, but she was very much indebted to this place, because even though the kind of tenets of this school were such that would seem to think like, well, they would not approve of her future line of work, she was just so grateful for the refuge that they provided and left the majority of her estate to this institution. And so from there, she used her dancing skills to become a burlesque dancer. And so she worked for companies like the Cracker Jack Burlesque Company and others, and toured around the Eastern Seaboard as a burlesque dancer, and then, you know, working on Times Square and in other places. And so while she was working burlesque, she met a very dashing man named Otto Klein.
Oh, was he ever dashing?
Yes.
I mean, he was the king of cowboys.
He was a world champion rider. Yeah, he was an amazing guy. And they met at a Wild West show where she was working, but she was not working on the more respectable side of things. She was working in the so-called annex, where the gentleman-only cooch show occurred, and she was shaking her stuff for audiences. And she and they met in the dining car of the train that carried the performers from showstop to showstop. And they dated for 2 years before they finally were able to kind of arrange a spot where they could be in the same place and get married. And that was in Pittsburgh in 1915. And they were so in love with each other. I mean, just absolutely head over heels. And the sad thing, of course, is that 5 weeks after they got married, Tiny was finishing up her round of burlesque performances in Baltimore, and she got a telegram at the end of the show that said that Otto had been trampled by a horse in a riding accident earlier that day. And she was advised to come back to New York and pick up his remains. And so she had a torturous train ride back to New York City, where she and Otto had just, you know, they had an apartment that they had set up where they were going to live together. And in any case, she was just devastated, but kept working. She was absolutely tough and got a job on Times Square. She worked in a dance review, worked with drag queen ice skaters in a performance at a big show called Hip Hip Hooray, and she did all sorts of other, you know, worked burlesque, did all sorts of jobs, and then she was hired on with the circus in 1916, so a year later. And initially, she did a kind of job that was very common for unskilled people in the circus. She was a good dancer, but they didn't really have use for her skills at that point in the circus. And she worked as a statue girl, meaning that she held a pose. She was virtually naked, dressed in thick grease paint, but little else. And she would maintain these classical statuary poses. And she did that for a year and then gradually moved up in the circus hierarchy, and she became a Roman rider, in which she would stand on top of a galloping horse and charge around an arena, and she'd do that. She did that for a year, and all the while cultivating skills so that she could become an act that would perform in the three ring, you know, kind of as a solo artist. That was her goal. And finally, she began working on the rings and the trapeze, until she got into a tiff with a fellow aerialist, a very famous aerialist named Lillian Leitzel, who was incredibly glamorous. I mean, she could stop the crowds, and she married a fellow trapeze artist named Alfredo Cadona, and they were literally, in the world of the circus, they were like Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford. I mean, it was that kind of celebrity. And Lillian Leetzel didn't like the fact that Tiny Klein was getting pretty good at her aerial act. And she said, you know, I think you need to focus on something that my mother did back in Germany called iron jaw work, literally where one hangs by their teeth and does all sorts of acrobatics by their teeth. And Tiny was built for the job. She had a very powerful neck and strong upper body and tiny little legs. And so she was built for that kind of work. And she thought, you know, it's better than trying to duke it out for center ring status with someone who's already incredibly popular. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give that up and I'm going to become an iron jaw performer. And she worked hard at it. And she describes it in torturous detail in the memoir, the feeling of, you know, the back of her neck cracking as she's holding this leather strap in her mouth. But she became really good at it and cultivated an act where she would hang by her teeth at the top of the arena, and they worked up a series of ropes that would give the illusion of the rope breaking, and then she would glide at top speed to the bottom of the arena at a kind of angle, and that was called a slide for life.
Mm-hmm. Which really, quite frankly, it was, because she didn't have a net under her.
No, absolutely not. And she was injured, you know, a few times during the course of her career, and it is just terrifying. In fact, after the book was in its final stages of production, I discovered footage of Tiny Klein on YouTube.
Really?
Yes, it is amazing. And she is performing. This is something she does talk about in the book. In 1932, she was working for a vaudeville company. And so to publicize this upcoming vaudeville show, Tiny and the publicity people of the vaudeville unit she was with decided that, you know, it would be a nice idea if she did a slide across Times Square. And so she literally ascended, marked it out with her feet across Times Square over 1,000 feet, and then climbed, went to the top of two different buildings, got permission from the building owner, and tied her apparatus, got it all set up. And then on October 21st, 1932, she did her slide. And the person who posted it on YouTube didn't know who she was, had no clue. But I saw it. I was able to find it through other means, and it is definitely her, and it is just amazing. And there are thousands of people below looking up at her. She goes hurling through the air, probably between 300 to 500 feet up in the air, and she lands at the top of this other building, and then in her wonderful Hungarian accent, she says, "At last, I have found a safe way to cross Times Square."
Oh, I love it. I love it.
Great.
Well, one of the other... Well, actually, there are many different facets to this memoir. She wrote this memoir because she felt if she didn't write it, a lot of circus history would be lost.
Yes.
And that, it's what she put in the material and your research on her as a person and all of this combined and her candor and relating different points of information. She talks about the hierarchy in the circus and how where your trunk, where your traveling trunk was placed showed your status.
Yes.
And how every performer had to do the safety check, and how one time she could have lost her life because the tension on the ropes, the cables that she was using, had not been properly adjusted. And she had to check everything out. But the culture of the times, I mean, it's, you've written here, it's a memoir of history. She talks about the different personalities, and she goes into the beginning. There was, what, 100 circuses, something like this, that were operating? I mean, this was big business for a while.
Huge business, yeah.
So when did Barnum and Bailey and Ringling Brothers bring their stuff together, and how did she get involved with them?
Well, she, Barnum and Bailey were really, it's a funny story, you know, just as a general story of the circus business is one of the most kind of ruthless, Gilded Age, robber baron history. These are folks who are absolutely astute businessmen. And these showmen were ferociously competitive with each other. And so Barnum actually He enters the circus business in 1871. He had been a museum owner for years prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked with other circus men and really was so innovative in all of these, you know, wonderful things that he did. He brought the show efficiently to the railroad. He, you know, hired Pinkerton agents to make sure that women and children would feel safe at the circus, because the circus had quite a tawdry reputation, you know, as a traveling entertainment, pickpockets and, you know, sneak thieves abounding, trying to rip people off. And so Barnum was out to sanitize the circus and make people feel safe in a lot of respects. That, I mean, it was still a pretty volatile place in a lot of respects, but nonetheless, he brought to it a degree of control and efficiency. And out of Baraboo, Wisconsin, there were a group of young brothers who opened their own circus. And this is the Ringling Brothers, of course. And they eventually, over time, became so adept in the business. And these are people who are not college educated. You know, they are essentially scrambling by their wits and learning as they go. And by the 1890s, the Ringling Brothers were pretty ferocious on their own terms. And so just to back up a teeny bit, Barnum then goes head-to-head into competition with another really great showman, James Bailey, who also had a circus. And so by 1880, they decided, enough is enough, we need to combine forces.
Mm-hmm.
And so they became the greatest show on earth together, Barnum and Bailey. And then by 1906, when James Bailey died, Barnum had died in 1891, so he was long gone. But James Bailey, upon his death, the Ringling Brothers bought his circus as well. And so they then ran all of these separate circuses, but then brought them all together in 1919 under this Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey's Greatest Show on Earth. And so that's the date at which Tiny Klein, you know, she is working on the show then. And her husband, incidentally, Otto, had worked for Barnum and Bailey, and that's how she got an in on that show initially,
mm-hmm.
back in 1916. She actually had visited the show, and there's a kind of weird serendipity, again, when she was in the arena. It happened to be on the anniversary of her husband's death, and she put her arms around his horse, and a photographer captured it. And the show was so taken by the kind of coincidence of this event that, you know, she wanted a job with the show, and given all of that, they decided to hire her. And that's when she became the statue girl initially, and then moved up in the show hierarchy. And so in 1919, when the shows combined, it was a really tough time, and Tiny really vividly brings that to life, I think, in the, you know, with the competing interests of the different people from different shows and always suspicious of each other. And, you know, she felt always a sense of her own kind of uncertain status on the show, given the fact that she started in burlesque.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she really talks about this sense that people would slight her and not make her feel so welcome at times, given the fact that she wasn't born into a circus family that had been in the business for, you know, centuries. Some of these families had
mm-hmm.
been, you know, all the way back to, you know, kind of working as acrobats for kings and such in Europe. And so she always felt that kind of outsider sense, even though she so fiercely loved her life on the show. And
well, if anyone is interested in knowing about a woman who at 70 years of age was Tinkerbell, believe me, this is a book that is absolutely mesmerizing, because when you're reading it, you feel like you're actually back in those years, and there's the technology that's evolving, there's the changes in show business, and all of the variables, and here she is. She gets to be in her 70s, and most people are going to be sitting in their rocking chairs, and not her. She's working out in her garage, keeping her muscles up.
Yes.
Comes Tinkerbell and is out there on a cable. I mean, this is just amazing.
Yeah.
So any of you people that feel like when you're old you're going to be decrepit, you need to read this. You need to read this book. Tiny is an inspiration, and she's left a wonderful legacy. And Janet, you have given the world a gift by doing this book, and I wish you the best with it. Do you have a website that people can go to find out more about this wonderful woman, and also about the circus.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I don't. I am so terribly outdated, but I would welcome anyone to contact me at any time, and I would be more than happy to share any information I have. And the other thing, of course, is that the University of Illinois Press, which has published the book, they have a wonderful series of links, both to the YouTube video footage and, you know, further information about the book. But I would welcome anyone to contact me and contact me at the university.
By the way, the University of Illinois Press, their website is press.uillinois.edu. That's press.uillinois.edu. Janet, thanks so much for being my guest today, and congratulations on a work very, very well done. It was mesmerizing to me.
Oh, thank you, Donna. It's been such a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you for being my guest again.
Great.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. Don't go anywhere. More good things to share. We'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, ttap.com.
Hello and welcome. This is Donna Sebo, and if you'd like to give me a buzz, the telephone lines are now open, and give me a call at 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Also, we have a direct line if you want to use that, 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. What happens? Well, if you're a first-time listener and you've not heard what's been done before, all you need to do is call into the station, and then when I get on the line with you, I'll want your first name or your initial, and of course I'd like to know where you're calling from. And then after that, let me do my thing, and I'll be happy to give you the insights that I have, and after that, you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you like. Again, 877-876-5227-888-815-9756 and 530-876-3222. We were talking about Tiny Klein and her being Tinkerbell, and here there is this estate that has been left, and there's all this material that nobody can do anything with because it's copyrighted, and there is the 70-year or 75-year period after someone dies where that material, you can't do anything with it. These are the rules. And it's amazing to me when you think about people like Tiny, and of course she wasn't considered world famous like Elvis, but property belonging to people that have died can become quite valuable. And I came across some information, and this was just amazing to me. Do you know the 10 highest paid dead celebrities that there are? Well, this came out of Forbes magazine. The first one is Elvis Presley. The annual earnings apparently are like $49 million a year on good old Elvis. John Lennon is in second place positioning. His is $44 million. Charles Schultz, M. Schultz, is $35 million. Of course, we all know him because of his beloved character, Peanuts. And George Harrison, the earnings on George Harrison, $22 million. Albert Einstein, he's in position number five, $18 million. Number six is Andy Warhol, earnings $15 million. And Dr. Seuss, wonderful guy, well, earnings $13 million. And Tupac Shakur, $9 million. Number nine in positioning is Marilyn Monroe, $7 million. Steve McQueen is in position number 10, $6 million. I'm telling you, it is amazing. So if you haven't made a will, and if you have something that you want to leave, believe me, go ahead and make one out. You can always change it as you get older. But just as with Tiny Klein, when she passed, she wanted most of her estate to go to the school that had helped her so much when she was younger. Lots of times people don't realize, if they don't have that sense of reality that when they die, if they don't have a will, things can go into probate and be stuck there for what seems like eternities until everything is settled. So do yourself a favor. I don't care how young you are, how old you might be, or if you're in the middle, in between. It doesn't make any difference. Do yourself a favor and have a will. Because sometimes when people do their original wills, then they decide they want to change their mind. And maybe the circumstances have changed. Maybe you don't have the same amount of property. Maybe you have more property. So it's important to remember to do that. And libraries, this is something that if you wanted to will it, it is to a library itself or to a special school, or if you have a collection you want to go to someone in particular, help people avoid hassle. You're not going to be here. You're not going to care. But make sure that people that are going to survive you do not have to go through very much in the way of hassle. I'm telling you, if you don't do it, it really becomes a problem. I remember a particular client of mine who passed away, and she had this family, and there were about six people in the family. Do you know her estate was worth a few million dollars? By the time the family members got through fighting with each other, the attorneys got all the money, but they ended up with maybe $5,000 apiece after everything was taken care of. So it just is wise, and also if you don't get a will, it automatically will go to the state, and depending on where you're living, it will go to the state. It will go into the state coffers. So if you don't want that to happen, take the time, make a will. Also remember that if you want things changed, have that done too. And be sure that you have it secured either with an attorney and or maybe with a couple of friends or special members of family that you know that you trust that will keep things locked away until they need to be read for the fact that you're not going to be around here. I mean, let's face it, we're all going to go sometime, every one of us, even though we like to think otherwise. Those are the realities. But anyway, I wanted to share that information with you because I think it's quite significant. And I want to thank, too, those of you that are sending me stories and information. And I want to say, keep it coming. I'm always interested in what you have to say. I may or may not be able to use it on the air, but if I do, I will try to fit it in with whatever I am working with. And by the way, if you want to give me a call, 877-8765-227, 888-815-9756, and 530-876-3222. All I need is your first name or your initial, and then after that, let me give you my intuitive insights. Now, tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the truth about beauty. Kat James is going to be my guest, and we are going to have a lot of fun with Kat. She's really a wise lady, and she's been in the beauty business for years, so we're going to enjoy chatting with her. Next week, we've got an interesting lineup of guests. Dwayne Graveline is going to be my guest. We're going to be talking about Lipitor. That is a statin. This is information that I think people need to know about. I have a great deal of respect for Dr. Graveline. He is a former NASA astronaut, and he himself has had personal experiences that you need to hear about so that you'll pay attention. Remember, if you're educated, then you can make better choices. If you're not educated and you're ignorant, then you cannot make choices because you don't know that you have them. So we don't want that to happen to you. Energy of belief. Mary Seitz is going to be my guest. We're going to talk about the power of your thinking and how you need to understand that your feelings, your emotions, and your imagination have a great deal of power in your life. Then we're also going to be talking about animals next week. Stephanie Lalland, Random Acts of Kindness by Animals. Oh, this is so much fun. Wonderful, wonderful true stories about animals and the way they have brought wonderful, wonderful good things into people's lives. One of my favorite people, Teresa Tapp, is going to be with us next week. We're going to be talking about how to stay fit, how to work with the body so that you, not only are you going to be toned, you're going to have wellness first in your life and have the energy to do what you want to do. And then Marie Jones is going to be my guest, 2013. A lot of people consider it an ominous year. Why? Well, it has something to do with the Mayan calendar and a little bit of this and a little bit of that. So we're going to find out about the little bit of this and the little bit of that and what Marie's research has brought forth. So that's our lineup for next week. I hope you'll tell your friends and don't want you to miss it. By the way, remember always we have the archives available should you want to get the show at a later time. Easy, just by touching a button. Coming in to bbsradio.com, go to the archive portion of the Donna Sebo Show, and you'll find what you want, and you'll be able to listen at your own leisure, busily working perhaps on something else, but being entertained at the same time. So we invite you to join us. Now, Greg sent me some information that this is all trivia kinds of stuff, but I had fun with it because it had to do with food. And he just felt that this would be something that would be just nice to share because here it is, you know, just summertime, people are loose and we're trying to figure out easier ways of doing things. So I just thought I would share a few of these little tidbits today. One of the things, you know, when we peel a banana, we always start at the top. But he found out some interesting information. He said if you peel a banana from the bottom, you won't have to pick the little strings off of it. And do you know how they figured that one out? That's how the monkeys do it. Aha! Thought that would get you. Now, when you take your bananas apart when you get home from the store, they are going to be slower in ripening than if you keep them connected. Also, if you want them to ripen a little bit faster, then you put another piece of fruit in a brown paper bag along with your bananas, and it's the gases from the fruits that create the ripening process. And he said, gee, in this heat, if you want to store cheese, and this is something to remember all year long, put them in aluminum foil. They'll stay longer and they won't mold. And this is something I didn't know. When you're buying your bell peppers, if you buy the peppers that have three bumps on the bottom, they're going to be sweeter, and they're better for munching. If you like to just have a little bit of dip, maybe you're on a diet and you're just eating a lot of veggies. And so if you have a pepper with four bumps on the bottom, they're firmer, and they're going to be better for cooking. Who would have thought? Three bumps? versus 4. Also, if you want to have a real good dessert, take any of your leftovers, Snickers bars especially, but I think you could do this with just about any candy bar. I think I'd be better with candy that's got lots of nuts in it. But all you need to do is chop them up with a food chopper, peel, core, and slice a few apples, put them in a baking dish, and sprinkle the candy bars over the apples. Bake them at 350 for 15 minutes. Serve it all by itself or on top of ice cream. Oh, I was talking about keeping the waist trim. After reading that, I think I expanded 3 inches. Oh, my goodness. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. We are going to go on a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Phone number 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. We'll be right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756. During the summer months, we have to remember to stay hydrated. It's very important. Would you like to know a way that you can determine if you're getting dehydrated? This is a very simple test that you can do on yourself. You can even do it with children. If you want to find out whether or not you've become dehydrated, what you do is pitch the skin on the back of your hand just in front of your wrist. If it springs back, you're hydrated. If a ridge remains where you've pinched up the skin or it slowly returns to normal, you're dehydrated. So you want to just do that occasionally. It's a real simple test, isn't it? It'd be a great way to be able to know whether or not you're getting enough water. Depending on where you live, you can dehydrate so very, very quickly. So be aware of that. I mean, if you watch the Olympics, you'll notice how it's very important to all of the athletes that they hydrate, and they hydrate very, very consistently because they want to make sure that they're at their peak. So that's important. Robotics. Is this something that you feel is going to become a very significant part of our lives? Well, it definitely is. We have the robotic units that they can put on the floors to clean them. I'm not excited about them yet because they don't pick them enough. If you've got animals, I just feel like it's just they've got a little tiny cup in them. But it's a beginning. It's a beginning. I'm waiting for Rosie. Did you see in the Jetsons? She's full size. She cleans the whole house. That's what I'm waiting for. Well, they're well on their way. Now, what it is, it's called biomimicry, imitating nature's designs and processes to create products for we humans. Now, this is really exciting in many ways because we feel that this is going to enable us to have a much more comfortable living environment. How about a self-cleaning paint? That sounds like a good idea to me. I hope it lasts 100 years so we never have to repaint after we do paint. But a self-cleaning paint based on Lotus Lace swimsuits made like shark skin, well, they're already there. Look at what they're using in the Olympics. Wind turbines in the likeness of whale flippers. They've done that. They've done that. They're all of this is already in place. However, other people are saying to themselves, we can do something else. Well, what they're trying to do now is mimic animals. They're studying nature, which is a very good place to begin, and they have developed robots that crawl, walk, and swim just like the animal in nature. Now, this research may end up developing all kinds of tools and assistance for us, and maybe even developing the type of robots that work right alongside with firemen and, you know, scuba divers and all kinds of people. This is something that they've got, and I've got photos of this in front of me. They have what they call a sticky bot. Now, this looks like a gecko, and it can hang on any smooth vertical surface with the adhesive feet. And how it manages to do that is its sticky bot's feet are covered with a thin polymer made up of tiny bristles along with branching tendons that distribute the weight of the robot evenly across the foot. Now, it's not just for looks that it's been designed like the gecko. What they found is that the long tail of the gecko style, that leverages against falling by pressing against the surface during a slip, allowing the foot to regain its grip. So it is amazing. And it's not very big. They also have what they call the fly. And I know, some of you are thinking that, gee, isn't this being used in spy stuff? And how many times over the years people have said, I wish I could be a fly on the wall in that meeting room just to hear what's going on. Well, guess what, folks? They're catching up with that one. This paperclip-sized machine, it's one of the smallest flying robots that has been invented to date. It beats its wings just like a fly, flapping about 110 times per second, and it lifts. All it weighs is about 2/1000ths of an ounce, and it can lift itself into the air. Now, they're trying to figure out how they can make this fly hover. And they're trying to figure out how they can equip it with cameras and sensors to check for survivors amid rubble or, who knows, maybe check on you. So we're going to have to figure out how to work with that one. However, these particular items that have been developed are only in labs at this time. You know, with human ingenuity and with the possibility of anything, the old adage is, if you can think of it, it can be done. Usually it can. It may take a while to get there to figure out how to do it, but that's what it is. Now, also they have what they call aqua jelly. And these are 8-tentacled swimmers created in the likeness of jellyfish. But it wasn't easy to get the movement of the jellyfish. So what they've designed is an electric motor that powers 2 cranks that connect to 8 rhombic joints. Creating a wave-like motion. Now, if they want to make it move in any particular direction, this artificial jellyfish follows the swing of what they have as an internal pendulum. Right now, it's more like an artistic exhibit, but they think it could be a jelly-powered submersible. Imagination. Jules Verne and H.G. Wells aren't the only ones. We've got a lot of people out there working on things that someone might have said in a million years it will never happen. Boy, is that wrong. You know, when I think of my guest that we just talked with yesterday, Stanton Friedman, and he said, there's all of this stuff that is out here that's being worked on, and a lot of things we don't even have a clue about what people are doing. So it's very interesting. We live in an interesting period of life. But I can never see the human being ever stopping his or her inventiveness. And it is something that will always be there. And personally, I'm grateful for it because I'll tell you what, anytime somebody comes up with one thing that might be considered as a negative, there's always going to be someone coming up with an alternative to it. It's amazing how the human mind works. This is Donna Sebo. We are out of time. Don't forget, tomorrow we're going to be talking about beauty. Cat James is going to be my guest. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You're the one that is going to be able to write your own legacy, if you so desire. So live your life as if you were writing it. And remember, what you do does make a difference. This is Donna Sebo. Have a fabulous day. I'll be back here same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Talk with you manana. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.